And good afternoon. It is 12:02. It's Friday. A little cold, but a little cloudy. But on the other hand, it's not snowing or ice falling from the sky. And of course, on Friday is our regular guest, State Senator, Wolfboro resident, Senate Majority Leader, Jeb Bradley. Senator Bradley, thanks again for making the time.
Always a pleasure. How are you?
I am well, sir. Everything going okay?
Everything's good.
Good. It's the new what do they call that? The new season is coming. A legislative season is coming up.
Yeah, we'll be reconvening in January. That is similar to, at least to begin with, what we did in 2021. The House is going to meet, I think, in the center of New Hampshire. The big ballroom, and the Senate will use the House chamber, so we try to, maintain some social distancing given the, threat of the variants and COVID. But we'll be able to get our work done.
Well, that's what's important, and I think it's probably better than a virtual meeting.
The House is almost impossible.
Right. Exactly.
We did do it. It's not, it's not ideal, but it, with 24 members, it's a lot easier. So.
What do you think of this Omicron or whatever it is?
Well, I think it was to be expected. I mean, this is what scientists tell us happens with viruses, that they do mutate. They, change over time. They also had suggested prior to Delta and Omicron that, new variants would, be highly transmissible, but probably not as, deadly, which so far that seems to be the case with the Omicron virus variant. So, we'll see what happens. I think, Governor Sununu had been predicting that there'd be an uptick in cases. There clearly has been in New Hampshire, but it's not, I just want listeners to know, Eric, it's not just New Hampshire. I mean, Maine, Vermont, all the northern states around us are experiencing surges, and it's not just, not just New England states, but across the country. In the southern part of the country, when it's hot in the middle of the summer, people tend to stay in air conditioning, and so they're inside, and that's when cases were surging, in places like Florida and Texas. Now, those states have seen dramatic drop-offs, and, in New England, we're outside in the summer, and, now we're congregating inside, and, so it's kind of to be expected. Our vaccination rate is, one of the better of states in the nation, especially among people that are over 65, where I think 98-99% vaccinated. In the 18 to 65 range, I think we're 70% vaccinated. And in the 12 to, 17 range, I think we're over 50%. So, people are getting vaccinated. They're getting their boosters. Tomorrow's a big day for, people to get boosters. And I think a lot of people, given, the ongoing nature of the pandemic, are wanting to get that booster shot. And, hopefully folks that, have up until now declined to get vaccinated will talk to, their providers and medical providers and, rethink it. And if it works for them, they, should get vaccinated. We need to make it as, readily available as possibly can. And I think the governor's doing a really good job and, making vaccines readily available. And that, to me, is the most important thing. But we do have to remember, I'm fully vaccinated and I have a booster at this point. And but it doesn't mean I can't get COVID.
Right.
A lot of people who are vaccinated have gotten COVID. It happens. That's the nature of this virus. But even if it doesn't prevent somebody from getting COVID, what, you know, all the medical professionals are saying across the board is your chances of getting a really bad case of COVID where you end up in the hospital or worse are much, much less if you're vaccinated. And I think it was, you know, when I thought about in the spring whether I was going to get vaccinated or not, just, you know, those were some of the issues that I thought through. And I felt that in my case, it was the right thing to do to get vaccinated. And once I got the first vaccination, it was like, all right, in for a dime, in for a dollar, get the booster. And I'm glad I did. But I still, you know, if I'm going out in public and going food shopping, things like that, you know, I always have a mask with me, and there are times that I would wear a mask. So, you know, I think we all have to do what's right for all of us and try to protect ourselves, our families, and respect our neighbors, and understand there are things that we can do to minimize the risk of spread without, you know, the heavy hand of, you know, government firing people if they don't get vaccinated or things like that. So,
yeah, I've noticed actually that, interestingly enough, a lot of these mandates are being at least temporarily overturned by courts. So there may be a bit
of
an
overreach. Well, I don't think any president has the authority to order a nationwide vaccine. Now, I think, you know, making vaccinations available, talking in non-political terms to everybody, every American, about, you know, the merits of vaccine, and also being willing to discuss, you know, where there may be issues with vaccines so people can make rational choices. Like if you're a young man, you know, there is a heightened risk of myocarditis, a heart ailment, you know, and trying to address them head on with facts, present all sides of the picture. Don't make it political. Don't shame people. You know, and I think then, you know, this is why New Hampshire, I think people do dig into the facts of the matter. And that's why we're one of the more vaccinated states in the country. And that's a good thing. But I think, you know, we need to sort of ramp down the politics behind vaccines and not threaten to fire people and undermine their ability to, you know, take care of their family or God forbid, if they're healthcare workers, you know, exacerbate the shortage of healthcare workers, but try to use the facts to let people know the merits of vaccine. And I think, you know, certainly what I did is I weighed the benefits and I weighed the risk. And to me, and I think this is probably the case for most people, you know, when you think about it rationally, the benefits outweigh the risks, especially, you know, I talked to my doctor and, you know, he said several things. He said, look, he said, most people are not going to have an adverse reaction to the vaccine, but my doctor told me that before he would recommend anybody getting a vaccine, he'd, you know, want to check their medical history, make sure that, you know, it was in their best interest to get vaccinated before that happened. And so I think, again, this is where talking to your provider, your medical provider, is probably a good idea, trying to get, you know, the facts of it as opposed to, you know, the all too often politics about vaccines that we're seeing, you know, every night on TV, which is unfortunate, and shaming one way or the other. It doesn't matter, you know, which side is being shamed, quite frankly, because both sides are, you know, pro-vax, anti-vax are shaming each other. And facts will, Americans will respond better to facts and cogent discussions than, you know, hurling of insults.
Oh, I agree with that. When people tell you that they're not vaccinated, a lot of people are almost proud of the fact. What is it that the main reason they tell you that they're not vaccinated?
So, several things, okay? I mean, obviously, younger people, myocarditis, that's an issue. There's some fear for women of childbearing age. That is an issue. There are a lot of people that have gotten COVID, and most medical experts think that gives a certain level of immunity that's probably better, at least in the short run. And quite frankly, with vaccinations, we don't know how long the coverage of a vaccine lasts either. But if people have already had COVID, you know, certainly they don't feel they need to get vaccinated. So those are three, like, just general things. And then the fourth thing would be talking to your provider, okay? Maybe you've had an adverse reaction to vaccines in the past. Who knows? Maybe there's something in your medical history that, you know, would lead your provider to say, I'm not sure this is a good idea. So I think those are all, Eric, rational reasons why people would decline a vaccine. Then another reason I think that some people, and I think with some justification, look, this vaccine was developed in record time. Yes, it had significant testing. It went through the whole FDA approval process, and that was all good. But I think people would rather sometimes see the test of time also. Had it been out for 5 years and widely used for 5 years, I suspect, you know, there'd be studies done about not only the efficacy of the vaccine, but any potential side effects of the vaccine. I think people, you know, are cautious about that before they ingest something into their body. So I think this is what I mean about we shouldn't be shaming people that decide for whatever reason not to get vaccinated. I think the discussion, and I've had this discussion with people, is I always tell people, talk to your medical provider, get good expert advice from people you trust that know your medical condition, and then make a decision. And obviously somebody that's not vaccinated probably needs to be, not probably, but definitely needs to be extra careful in terms of, you know, social distancing and trying to respect, you know, the rights of others and to protect their own health care. So, you know, there are plenty of ways to, whether it's wearing a mask, and I'm not sure of the, you know, masks are not foolproof. Let's put it that way. They're probably somewhat effective, but certainly not being in large crowds, not standing too close to people, you know, being at least 6 feet apart. You know, these are all things, vaccinated or unvaccinated, that, you know, people should be thinking about at this point in time to try to stem that, you know, the pandemic. But at the same time, we also, you know, we got to live our lives, and people have to go to work, and they have to support their families, and families need to be able to visit with each other, and friends have to stay friends, and, you know, Zoom works to a certain extent, and telephone and Skyping and all those other things, but face-to-face is important too, but you can still be safe and be together with just some common sense. And, you know, that 6 foot, you know, distance between people is pretty helpful.
Yeah, it is. Even though some outdoor events were canceled, Laconia's Pumpkin Fest was canceled for the second year in a row. If you're outside, isn't that just the perfect place to be distant?
I think if you are in a very tight crowd of people outside for, you know, more than just a few minutes, I think that is risky. But if you're outside, you know, look, for instance, all summer and fall, restaurants had outdoor seating. And I don't think there was too much to worry about because there's plenty of space between people. There's airflow. There's, you know, is there a risk? Of course, there's always a risk of transmission of a virus, whether it's COVID or any other virus. But it's a minimal risk. And I think that's where a little bit of common sense in how, you know, we do the things that we do, can help to prevent the spread of the virus. But remembering when, you know, when it gets cold, you got to be inside. And so you just, you know, extra caution is a good thing.
What do you say to the, or what do you think of the roughly 75, 80,000 people that are at Gillette Stadium to watch the Patriots?
So again, it's outside. I'd say probably 70% or 80% of them are vaccinated, okay? So most people are vaccinated. You know, look, I'm as big a Patriots fan as there is. And I will tell you this, I much prefer watching a game from the comfort of my living room or at a friend's house than going, you know, to the game, just because it's such a long drive from Wolfsburg down to Foxborough and back. So I'm pretty partial to that. But I don't see any reason at this point why we need to start canceling these things. We need to use common sense. And if, you know, if people feel they're vulnerable to it, then those are the type of situations to avoid. But if you're vaccinated, then I think, yes, there's a risk that you can, you know, get COVID in a situation like that. But, you know, there are things that you can do to, and you're outside. So I think it's okay.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about some of the actions the Executive Council did as far as COVID and some federal grants from the, I can't think of the name of it, American Act or whatever.
Rescue Act. Yeah.
Thank you, the American Rescue Act. Thank you. There was the original controversy where they did not approve the, was it $27 million because of a fear of a mandate, but that was later accepted, right?
That was later accepted. The Executive Council passed a resolution, you know, going on record saying that, you know, accepting of the funds did not mean we're accepting federal mandates. The Attorney General, John Tremella, had made it very clear that there were, you know, those kind of strings were not attached to the money. So it was designed to expand the access to vaccines. So, you know, look, I thought it was good that they accepted it. I know that, you know, there was some opposition to it. I respect that, but I quite frankly don't agree with it. What they just accepted earlier this week was money to help hospitals expand bed capacity so that whether it was nursing homes or ambulatory surgery centers, they could take some of the overflow patients. And my understanding is we're at about 470 people that are hospitalized right now in New Hampshire. That is, you know, very high. And, you know, the governor, I think, has done a good job of trying to expand bed capability in these other facilities. He's also called out some of the National Guard folks that could help with, you know, the situation. So, you know, I think we're doing everything that we can, short of just locking down businesses and events, which I don't support, and quite frankly, I don't think would, you know, you just can't lock people down forever. And people have to earn a living, and they have to see their friends, and they're not, you know, now that we're almost into this, you know, people are living their lives. The thing that we need to try to do is be sensible. And whether it's getting vaccinated, you know, utilizing social distancing, I think that's very important. But, you know, undermining our economy or, you know, some of the things that come with the lockdowns, inability for patients that have other ailments, whether heart or cancer, diabetes, et cetera, to get their normal, you know, routine checkups or their treatments, or mental health has exploded, the problems of mental health because of people, especially youngsters, being separated. You know, we've got to be cognizant of those things too, Eric. The lockdowns have a very harmful effect, you know, across the board. And I think, you know, Governor Sununu has tried to walk that line between protecting the public health, which I think he has done, but not going so far that we go back into, you know, really what I think would be a disastrous type of lockdown.
Well, I don't think that would happen. I'm not even sure people would stand for that anymore. The problem is, it seems that the pool of information changes almost daily. You know, Omicron is more contagious, but it may be less virulent. At some point, you just throw your hands up and you say, I don't know what's going on.
And there is some of that, too. And I think, you know, there's some in the national media that, you know, are overhyping COVID without, especially when a new variant comes on, like Omicron, without knowing all the facts. And so, you know, the variant's only, been discovered for 2 or 3 weeks?
Yeah, about
that. There's probably a lot more that we don't know than that we do know. But so far, what you just said is correct. Highly transmissible, but nowhere near as deadly as the original COVID-19, which, if I understand the science correctly, and I think I do, is sort of par for the course of how a virus runs itself out and how it mutates until, you know, all of us in this entire world sort of develop, you know, a herd immunity that, you know, comes with exposure to the virus. And you know, we're in the process of doing that. A pandemic becomes what's known as endemic, which means the virus is present, but it's not to the level of a pandemic, more like, you know, the ordinary flu, that people have natural antibodies, or in the case of being very vaccinated, antibodies from a vaccine.
Okay. I find it interesting, though, that the common cold is a coronavirus and mutates constantly as well. I'm wondering if, this is just speculation, I wonder if the vaccine companies are working on that. Maybe the COVID vaccines may have given them an idea on how to do something about the cold.
Well, who knows? I mean, look, I think that we're going to look 10 years from now, we're going to look back on this, and there's probably going to be, you know, a great leap forward, so to speak. Not to quote Mao Zedong, but I just did.
Right.
In terms of our knowledge that's developed of how to deal with a pandemic. And that'll be a good thing. And these viruses are, you know, they're made from RNA, and they're a little bit different than a historic vaccinations in the past. Don't ask me to explain it, but, you know, companies like Moderna, Pfizer, J&J have done a really good job of, I think, as long as the efficacy in the long run, and again, that risk-benefit analysis I talked about, and the long-term implications are not harmful, as virtually everybody that's looked at this says they don't believe it will be, we're going to have learned a lot about the creation of vaccines through this process. I mean, so, you know, it's awful tough going through it right now. People have had it, you know, and rightfully so. It's just incredibly disruptive. But, you know, that, I guess you could call it potentially a silver lining down the road.
Last week we had some visiting nurses in here from Cornerstone VNA who were really terrific. And they said that it's entirely possible, depending, I mean, we don't know yet, that you may have to get a COVID booster every year, like your flu shot.
And that could well be the case. I mean, again, there are a lot of things that we don't know. And, you know, people say, well, just follow the science. But science is an exploration, too. You know, it's not, 2 and 2 equals 4. I mean, I'm oversimplifying it. The hypotheses get tested into, you know, generally accepted conclusions, but you have to start with a hypothesis, and that's how the, you know, science works. It's going to be some trial and error. There's going to be a lot of learning, you know, that we do, and, you know, discovery. And I think, you know, at first people were saying, this was, you know, February of 2020, no, you don't need to change your life, masks, you don't need to wear masks, you know, don't worry, it's not going to happen in the United States. And then we saw Italy go into absolute chaos and lockdown. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, the same thing was happening in the United States. So there's a lot that we have learned from this, and we don't know everything all at once. There's a lot of information that comes out as a result of some of the things that we learned. And that's how the scientific process works.
Okay. 12:28 here on WASR. We're talking with Jeb Bradley, of course, Senate Majority Leader. Let's kind of look at that. Was it $68 million that the Executive Council accepted recently?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, one of the things that was included in that money, if I heard the news article properly, was the support of traveling, or what they call strike nurses. Mm-hmm. And I have heard, and I don't know how true this is, but my daughter says it's true, that it can be $200 or $300 an hour by the time you're done paying the agency and everything else. I mean, that just doesn't seem sustainable, does it? I mean, my mechanic doesn't get that.
Yeah, look, I think this is meant to be a short-term strike force type of thing. As I said before, you know, what the governor's tried to do is call up the guard, you know, so that's helpful. Expand bed capacity in ambulatory surgery centers or nursing homes to take some of the pressure off hospitals, and a strike force of medical professionals to go into the areas that they're most needed. I mean, for instance, it would be as if you had some sort of an event in a area of New Hampshire, you know, I don't know what, a flood, a fire, a, you know, horrific car accident, that you had to call in professionals from elsewhere, sort of like mutual aid in fire departments. And I think that that's what, as I understand it, this task force is designed to do. But, you know, hopefully as we get into the new year and through the holidays, you know, the worst of it, and this is what happened last year, is going to subside. And, you know, hopefully as we get into spring and the weather gets better, we're outside more, more people have been exposed, more people are vaccinated. We're at that herd immunity point where it's not a pandemic, but more endemic, which means it's with us, but it's not as debilitating because more and more people have, whether it's through vaccination or exposure, have antibodies and ability to cope with it.
It just seems like an awful lot of money. I believe it was $68 million. And that was just for Little New Hampshire.
Well, we have a healthcare worker shortage, too. And yeah. So, you know, making sure, and one of the things that Governor Sununu, I think, rightfully did, you know, is pay stipends to healthcare workers to keep them on the job. And so, you know, I think that's something that's, you know, we've got to do.
While we're on the subject of the governor, were you relieved that he is not going to be making a run on Washington?
So, you know, I think I've said this many times. Chris Sununu's been a great governor, and I think that I've enjoyed working with him. He would have been a good U.S. senator. Obviously, it's a very personal decision. You've got to think about your family. You've got to think about, you know, what happens if you win. It's a six-year term. and it's a big commitment. And I think, you know, in his case, he felt that he could do more for New Hampshire continuing to be governor. I've enjoyed working with him and look forward to, you know, continuing to do so.
Is there anyone that you can see that might give him a run for his money on the Republican side, at least at this early stage?
In a primary?
Yes.
No. No, I think, you know, somebody might jump in against him. You know, Karen Testaman ran against him and primaried him, you know, in 2020. And what did she get? I think 10% of the vote. So I think Chris Sununu is sitting pretty in terms of any primary. And I, quite frankly, I think, you know, he'll do quite well in a general election, too.
Oh, I'm sure he will. I mean, his polling has been excellent, and his ratings have been excellent. So I'm sure that if he wants another term of governor, he'll be able to get it. We're talking, of course, with Jeb Bradley, Wolfboro resident and New Hampshire Senate Majority Leader. Appreciate your time, really do. So let's kind of move on for a minute. I also noticed that one of the things that is not in that bill or is in the Build Back Better Act is the roads and bridges parts of things. I know that's past the House. The other thing that concerns me, and maybe hopefully you know more about this than I do, I'm sure you do, is the debt ceiling issue. From what I understand, we have a hard limit of, was it the 15th of December?
Yes, and my understanding is there's been an accommodation reached that is going to allow the debt ceiling to be expanded.
Oh, that's really good to know. I was under the impression that Speaker McConnell said that he was absolutely not going to help at all. Was that just a...
Well, he was saying that, and apparently he changed his mind. So.
Okay. That's good to know. So, because all I could think of, and I was talking about this morning, that a default on U.S. government debt would be catastrophic. And I think
yes,
a lot of people don't understand that.
I think that generally there's bipartisan support for extending the debt ceiling, generally. But right now we're, you know, we've increased the national debt so much as a result of COVID. And then, you know, the American recovery legislation that passed in February, the infrastructure bill that just passed, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, and now, you know, President Biden's Build Back Better is causing, I mean, the numbers came out this morning, Eric, a 40-year high in inflation. And so a number of people in Washington were saying, if we expand the debt ceiling, it's going to give free rein to the people that just want to spend forever to pass the Build Back Better, which really isn't about infrastructure like roads and bridges and tunnels and airports and things like that, but, you know, more social spending. And there's just a lot of opposition to that, and rightfully so. Just on its own, you know, on its own merits, it's problematic. But in any case, you know, we'll see what happens. It doesn't look right now like Build Back Better is going to pass. I think Senator Manchin has made it very clear he's very worried about the inflationary pressures that are all this spending is causing. The new numbers out today are terrible, 40-year inflationary high. If anything, it strengthens, I think, his resolve. And there isn't a single Republican vote, and he would be the 51st no vote, and that's it. And probably there are two or three other Democrats that secretly hope that he holds the line so that they don't even have to vote on it. I mean, I think of Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona or John Tester from Montana are more traditional conservative, not progressive Democrats. And, you know, I think there are a handful that are seeing the ravages of inflation. And who does inflation hurt the most? Okay, it's working Americans. I mean, the price of gas is up 60%. The price of food is up 7 or 8%. And these things are just rippling through the economy. And, you know, I mean, it was almost ridiculous last week. You know, the arm of the Democratic Congressional Committee was claiming success because, you know, the price of gasoline had dropped 2 cents. Well, guess what? It's up over, you know, I think about $1.25 a gallon, you know, since the beginning of the year. So inflation hurts hardworking Americans, and it's like this gigantic tax, and it's getting worse. And, you know, people are trying to provide for Christmas for their kids, or, you know, store shelves are empty, supermarkets are limiting purchases in places, you know, things like that. It's just the supply chain is, you know, these are decisions that have gotten made over the last 10 months in Washington, and they've been problematic, and I think we're seeing the results of it.
Well, we've kind of gotten used to a just-in-time supply chain, and obviously the pandemic has upended that. So I guess the next question is, do we need to reassess our thinking and say, okay, you know, let's look at carrying more inventory or making it in different places so we're not as vulnerable to shocks as we are now?
You know, I think you're going to see that happen, and it's already happening. I mean, look at products that are made in America right now and how people are advertising that they're made in America. And they're saying, no supply chain shortage, you know? And I think you're going to see that change. It doesn't happen overnight. It happens over time. Probably a little bit more expensive, but a little bit more certain. So, yeah.
You know, what I found is interesting is the price of my indulgence, Diet Coke, has gone way up, especially if you drink it in cans. From what I understand, there's an aluminum can shortage. And that's why, in case you like a soda that is not one of the more popular models, you may have trouble finding it. And I found
interesting. I read something this morning that beer manufacturers are worried about aluminum. And,
right.
You know, so it's same thing. These things are rippling through our economy, and they're definitely problematic.
Over the last couple of years, the price of recyclables has fallen through the floor to the point where a lot of people aren't even bothering anymore. Do you think this might, especially in things like aluminum and glass and things that are in short supply during the supply crunch, do you think that might come back?
So aluminum cans are one of the few things that there's still a really good market for. It was the problem, as I understand it, and some towns even, you know, shut down their recycling efforts for a period of time. I know in Wolfboro's case, the transfer station did not accept plastic for almost a better part of a year because the plastic was going to China to, you know, be remanufactured into whatever. Now it's open again, but I'm sure the cost has gone up. So who knows what, you know, that's going to mean. I mean, I can tell you this, we have a long-term landfill capacity issue in New Hampshire, and we've got to confront it. Any expansion of a landfill needs to be done, you know, in the most scientifically and environmentally appropriate way possible. And I think you can do that And we need to encourage reuse and recycling at the same time. But, you know, during the pandemic, I remember there was a piece of legislation in 2020 that would have outlawed single-use plastic bags, but they were the best bag, you know, to prevent COVID-19. And remember, for a period of time, you couldn't bring your own plastic bags to the supermarket, and they used single-use plastic bags. So, you know, these things are very intertwined, and that's why sometimes, you know, these sweeping public policy, you know, things that people promote, like the Green New Deal, you know, just moving to an all renewable energy future. I mean, sounds great in principle, but look what's happened in the United States, where, you know, we killed the Keystone Pipeline. We've stopped leasing of oil and gas wells. The companies are not making the investment in the infrastructure that they need to produce the type of domestic supply that we had. And we were, for the first time in 50 years, we were energy independent, you know, just a short year ago. That's all changed now. And what's happened to the price? So it's all well and good to move to, you know, a more renewable, greener future. We should be doing that. And nobody has, you know, worked harder in New Hampshire, I think, for renewable energy than I have. But you got to do it with some common sense. And you can't, you know, just say, okay, we're going to go and do this on day one. And wind and solar are great as long as the sun's shining and the wind is blowing. But it doesn't, you know, always happen. And there'll be other, you know, types of renewable energies that will be marketable in the future with batteries. But there has to be a transition. And, you know, it just is really important to be sensible about these things as opposed to, you know, thinking that your lofty ideas of the way that's going to work in the average household. It doesn't work that way. People have to heat their homes. They have to drive to work. It's pretty simple.
Where does nuclear power? Where does nuclear power fit in all of this? Obviously, the construction cost is a big negative, but does that figure into this new greener future?
It should. I mean, I think that you know, nuclear power has always been politically problematic. It's not scientifically problematic. You can, you know, safely store and dispose of spent uranium rods. It can be done. It's not cheap, but it's certainly possible. But politically, it's a problem. And so, you know, we should maintain the nuclear fleet that we have. And to me, I think we should be expanding the safe use of nuclear power, too. There's no carbon. There's no fuel except for uranium. We can do it, but you got to get over the political problems, and our nation so far hasn't done that. But again, nuclear power is only part of an energy solution. We need to be developing, you know, and we are, battery technology. As batteries become, you know, more widespread and efficient economically, and that's right now the problem, then we'll be able to store, you know, whether it's solar energy or tidal energy or wind energy. And that'll be a just, you know, the way that the internet was a breakthrough in communicating, that'll be a breakthrough in energy. But we're not there yet, you know.
Long as we're on that subject, you said, of internet, how is the broadband coming? Was there any money in the federal money for that?
Yes. I mean, there's, you know, we're waiting for the final guidance from the Treasury Department. I talked to, you know, the person that is administering the grant program yesterday, and one of the towns in my district, I reached out to their select board, pretty rural community. You know, so for any local official in any of, you know, the Lakes region listening now, if towns want to expand their internet capacity, there will be money available in the near time frame, probably 2 to 3 months from now. So the process that what towns should do now is work with their broadband providers, Brooks Atlantic Broadband, and other towns at Spectrum, and some towns that may be Comcast, those are the, you know, or Charter Communications, and to come up with a plan. So mapping is really important. What areas of the town are not served or underserved? What is it going to take to run the wires, you know, down the streets to get into people's homes? And the telecommunications companies working with the towns on a map can then price it out. And then I think we're going to have over $100 million pretty readily available from federal funds to provide matching grants to, you know, cities and towns working with their providers. So that's kind of the process at this point. Still, I mean, I wish it was wave a magic wand and it gets done, but that's the process. And, you know, I think that 6 months from now, hopefully we're talking about, you know, a lot more wires that have been strung, but, you know, important to know that there are supply chain issues with ordering, you know, the kind of cable that is necessary too. So it's never a dull moment.
Yeah, it seems it, but here we are as taxpayers subsidizing a private business to take on more customers.
Yes, you could look at it that way. And that's why I think up until now, when towns had contracts with cable companies for TV and internet service, they went to the areas of the town that were affordable to serve. And generally speaking, in most towns, that would be 80 to maybe as high as 90% of the town. But there are always going to be pockets in the more rural towns in northern New Hampshire that just were uneconomic to serve, okay? So there are two ways of doing it, okay? You could do it in the electric model or the old phone model where it was a public monopoly that, you know, had to be regulated, rate set by the Public Utilities Commission, and then you serve every home, and the cost is socialized of the far-flung regions. Or, you know, it's very expensive in cities, obviously, to run wires underground, too, but the costs are all socialized in everybody's rates that are set by government. But what you also have is not an awful lot of innovation. You don't have aggressive leaps in sort of technology or new ways of doing things. And you just have sort of a command and control process. And I think we've seen that in once especially the telephone industry got deregulated and how, you know, wireless exploded in terms of the technology and the products that were offered, and all of that came from a result of deregulation, as opposed to, you know, you can get any phone that you want as long as it's black. That used to be the case 30 years ago, okay? So that's the other model that the cable companies and the telecom companies, you know, because it was for profit, when they would negotiate a contract with towns, they would serve the areas of the town, again, 80 to 90% of the town, that was profitable. So now what we're trying to do, and yes, we're using public money to do so, is to, with the advent of the grants, subsidize running of the wires in the hard-to-reach areas, which were a lot more expensive to run wires to get internet service to every home. And, you know, the reasons, I think we've talked about this many times, you know, obviously being able to stay in touch with family, telecommuting, medicine is getting more and more consultations, you know, over the internet, and just monitoring of people's medical conditions. So education, obviously, through the pandemic, I mean, the internet has never been more necessary, and that's why I think, okay, it's okay to put, you know, some grant money behind, you know, the effort to expand broadband. But the way that my legislation works, it was a 50-50 split of grants. So state and federal funds constitutes 50%. The other 50% is a combination of either municipal funding or provider funding. So it's not like the providers are off the hook. They're going to have to come up with, you know, in some instances, probably 50% of the money to run the new wires that are necessary. But they'll get the customers, so it's in their interest. But, you know, that's why we're in the situation we're in. We didn't go the route of, you know, phone lines and electric lines, which are public monopolies. And I think, you know, on balance, we're way better off for the explosion in, you know, innovation that we've seen as we've deregulated the phone industry in particular over the years. And we're better off doing it as a for-profit as opposed to a publicly regulated entity.
I'm sure you've dealt with representatives from the cable companies before. I know a lot of people have Atlantic Broadband, and, well, everyone loves to hate their cable company, and I have nothing against it. But it does seem that a lot of people, myself included, aren't really looking at the type of speeds that were promised. Is there money in there to help that as well, or is it just for new customers?
So it's primarily to get new customers, but it doesn't preclude expansion up to, you know, 100, whatever it's called, 100 megabytes per second, I think.
Yeah.
Download and upload speed. And we put that standard into the legislation because speed is important.
It is, and it's one of those things that you don't know you needed until you get it. I'm lucky enough to have gig speed internet in my home, and it's transformative. You can have four or five people all watching HD streams and not even a hiccup. It's pretty amazing. It really
Absolutely.
Is.
And that is the, you know, the wave of the future. So I think, again, making sure that there's access for people that may live in more remote rural areas or even in some urban areas that are hard to serve, too, is pretty important for our entire country.
Right. Has there been any other interaction with the cable companies as far as, you know, you've seen it every couple of years, they'll have to pull a channel because of a financial dispute or anything like that. That doesn't affect anything like that, does it?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so. 12:55 here on WASR, and we're talking with Jeb Bradley. We still have a few minutes left, so hopefully we'll be able to entertain you for a few more minutes. What is or what are some of the wins against the broadband bill, as far as, do you think that the companies will spend the 50% that they need to?
Yeah, no, I think they will, because it's a big incentive for them, because they're going to have customers, you know, and their capital costs, which were prohibitive, you know, toward those last 10% of people, now they're going to have, you know, they're going to cut those capital costs significantly. Look at the long-term customers. So I think they've, you know, look, I worked with them to obviously have their support, and they see it as an opportunity, you know, to make it work financially. And so, yeah, it's a subsidy, but I think it's a necessary subsidy. Now, look, we all pay the gas tax to make sure that, you know, we have roads and bridges. And so this isn't really that much different.
Okay. We got a few minutes left, and part of my notes I skipped was we were talking about inflation earlier. Usually, the number one way to combat inflation is to raise interest rates, but I've heard that may not happen. Well, next year is really next month, Do you think that's an appropriate way to kind of battle this? Because they tried that in the 70s, and it didn't work very well.
Well, eventually it chokes off the economy if you raise interest rates. And as you decrease demand by raising the cost of, you know, borrowing, it brings inflation back under control. But it has a human effect, too. You know, everybody's credit card bills go up, their home mortgages go up, their, you know, car payments go up. So it, you know, the inflation is a insidious tax. In particular, it hurts, you know, hardworking Americans, middle class people, the most. And, you know, it's with us now. And the probably the best thing that, you know, folks in Washington could do is stop the spending bonanza and try to get our federal deficit, you know, a little bit more under control. It's not an easy process, but, you know, this spending bonanza, paying people not to work, things like that, that needs kind of to end.
The skyrocketing price of Medicare was kind of a bit of a strange thing. I mean, payments are going up, what, 5.9% for a COLA? But Medicare is going up more than that.
Doesn't surprise me. I mean, if you look at the, you know, the cost of health care in America right now with a shortage of health care workers, and it's a very labor-intensive industry, as much as technology comes into play, it's still very labor-intensive. Retaining good, you know, nurses, doctors, lab technicians, et cetera, is very difficult right now because there's a shortage of those workers. Those costs are going to go up just driven by the shortage of workers.
Well, if I remember properly, the last unemployment figure, which was yesterday, had new claims at, a 35-year low. I mean, have we reached the theoretical full employment?
No, I think that we're far from it. What's happened is a lot of people have just dropped out of the workforce, and whether it's long-term unemployment or some other government payment has encouraged that. And so, yes, the unemployment rate has gone down, but the new hirings were terrible when they were released last week. And so, you know, there are some 10 million jobs that are unfilled across the country right now, and that's a problem. I mean, you think the supply chain shortage is going to get any better? Not when you're almost 100,000 truckers short in this country.
Yeah, that's got to go somewhere. Unfortunately, we are out of time. It's 1 o'clock. Senator, thank you again for your time. You really, really make an hour go by quickly.
All right. Well, there you go. And hope everybody has a good weekend and happy holidays.
You as well, Senator. Thank you.
Take care.
You too. It is 1 o'clock. News is next.